Greetings from K9 to Diddly-Dum, Diddly-Dum, Diddly-Dum. End of message.
Faithless listeners, and welcome to episode 159 of the Diddly Dum podcast, the fourth best Doctor Who podcast out there. I'm Doc.
I am Hayden.
And I'm not Mick. And I'm Mark.
Well, first of all, faithless listeners, may wish you a happy new year, happy and safe new year. You join us as ever, or invariably, on our first podcast of each year, in that it is our birthday episode. We are now 8 years old on the 15th of January 2014.
I think I was in short trousers back then. It was very, such a long time ago now.
Cheers, boys.
Chin chin. Chin chin.
Charge your glasses of dandelion and burdock.
That's a lovely vintage.
Is that liquid nitrogen in Mark's, by the sounds of it? That's... Did anybody receive any Doctor Who-related gifts at Christmas? Or?
I did, actually. I received from my sister the Season 17 Blu-ray box set. So...
Oh, sorry. That was the Dandelion and Burdock. Sorry.
Hayden, 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 save your bile. Save your bile, surely. And funny enough, you know, last time we recorded, I mentioned a K1 enamel badge.
Oh, yes.
That I got for Christmas. This year, I got a K9 enamel pin badge. So I'm not sure if my sister had been listening to the podcast and had fallen asleep during that bit. But she bought me a K9 enamel pin badge, which is absolutely beautiful. And I've put it on my... on my jacket. Unfortunately, the K9's blue, not the traditional Daypol green.
Oh. Are you looking forward to receiving K2 to 8?
Well, yes. I don't know what's happened to them.
Lost in the post, probably.
The National Association of Mountaineers sent me a very nice present. A little badge of the second highest mountain in the world. It was yes, a K2 badge. K1, K3, K... I can't think of any more K puns.
K what? Small chickens? Oh, K puns, not K puns.
Oh dear, oh dear. No, unfortunately, despite the fact that I was very modestly bragging on our Christmas podcast that I'd asked my relatives if they wanted to spend anything on me for Christmas presents, I should donate it to a charity book appeal, which left me with nothing. I felt very proud up until Christmas Day when I started regretting it immensely.
I also got the Keys of Marinus B&M character options figure set as well with William Chesterton and two mysterious Vord. So that was nice.
A B&M, who sold themselves into slavery in order to get that for you?
Again, that was my sister's. That's the only one I got, though, so... I believe one of our listeners may be holding on to another box set for me, so I must get in touch with them.
Oh, yes, of course, yes. Hayden, do you get anything Doctor Who-wise for Christmas?
Well, you know what? I thought that I'd gone a clean sweep this year with absolutely no Doctor Who presents whatsoever. It turned out that actually there was one, and it was slightly late in the post, so I got it a few days after Christmas. Didn't fit through the letterbox, so The doorbell rang, so I picked it up and I took a look at it and I thought, what's this chunky VHS-sized looking box? What's in here? Really bizarre. So anyway, I tore open the packaging instantly and Season 17 on Blu-ray.
Oh, see, God does love you.
Should we change our plans today and do a Nine-Mon review?
Oh, oh yes, again? Oh, sorry, lad. Sorry, you're breaking up. I can't hear you very well. Oh, looks like I'm going to have to turn off. Oh, no. It's that season. And there it is on the shelf now, looking at me, mocking me, saying,
I'm more loved than some of the episodes you love.
Yeah, that's it.
I got a knock on my front door shortly after Christmas. I opened the door, and guess what I found? I found a gang of men digging a black hole on my doorstep.
What?
One of you is supposed to say, digging a black hole on his doorstep. How can I be the only one who knows the script to Nine-Mon off by heart when the Mark's the only one who likes it?
Yeah, it doesn't mean I've listened to it recently. It doesn't mean I have any sort of memory.
That's probably why he likes it.
Oh.
Did you know that someone's building a black hole on your doorstep?
What?
Yes. I got stuck in it, along with one of your spacecraft.
Digging a black hole on my doorstep.
Hayden, of course, spent his first Christmas as a father.
Yep.
Oh, hang on. Does that mean that Father Christmas visits you again now?
He does. He does. I asked him what had happened to the intervening 15 years or so. But, yeah, it's great to see him again.
Things didn't go entirely according to plan for all of us. Because Mark discovered on... Was it on Christmas Eve you found out, Mark?
Oh, no. Boxing Day. But on Christmas morning, I found out that somebody who I'd seen 4 days earlier had come down with COVID. So I had to cancel my plans for Christmas Day. And I had to do what I did last year, which is just deliver presents to my family's doorstep and not go in the houses just in case. Because I was worried, I didn't want to pass on the infection.
Oh, that's right. You self-isolated for Christmas Eve, didn't you?
Well, I wasn't self-isolating as such. It was just, it would have been a silly risk to go into other people's houses, especially when they're having other members of their family over on Christmas Day, elderly relatives and stuff. If I've been in contact with somebody a few days ago, I just thought there's a small risk. Anyway, it turns out that I was wise to be cautious because on Boxing Day, I felt a bit rough when I woke up in the morning and I tested positive. So, yeah. So I had to... 10 days in isolation. And I kept testing throughout the last few days, hoping that I'd be able to get out of isolation quicker. And no such luck. I didn't have a clear test until the 11th day.
God.
Yeah. Well, I had the joy of coming up to Manchester to spend Christmas with my mother, only to find that she popped into hospital a few days before Christmas for a routine test. And they decided to keep her in all over Christmas and into New Year. And when they finally let her out, 2 days later, they phoned her again to say, oh, Mrs. Hume, you know that routine PCR test that we gave you when you left the hospital? It's turned out positive. So currently, my mother and I are self-isolating in Manchester, far away from the museum. All I've got is on a very shaky Skype connection from Manchester. I can just about see the boys in the atrium. Where are you? So, could you both just step out from behind that surprisingly large stack of original artwork that seems to have come from somewhere, Hayden?
Yep.
Oh, there you are.
There I am.
Almost not too bad. She's not lucky enough not to get too terrible a dose of it, but... we're just being careful of things.
But she still managed a tennis tour of Australia, though, didn't she?
Yeah. Oh, dear.
Right, well, shortly before we broadcast our Christmas episode, listeners, we learned the sad news of the death of Chris Achilleos. And we didn't want to mention it on the introduction to our Christmas podcast, because I thought it would be inappropriate for us then to spend the rest of the podcast having fun and laughter about it.
So we're talking about it on a Chris Chibnall episode review one where there won't be any laughter and fun.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, okay. Just checking.
This was much more appropriate.
A much more somber mood. Yeah.
Chris is a guy we used to see in his corner of the dealer's room every time he went to the Dwarfs Capital convention. But as those of you who've listened to our podcast number 49, way back in January 2016, will know, one of us got rather closer to Chris, didn't he, Hayden?
Oh.
Yes, I am the other woman. No, it was back in 2015, a friend of mine who was affiliated with the Dwas managed to get me an interview with Chris Achilleos at his home in Chingford. Now, when he passed away the other day, the first thing I felt was obviously sadness, not only because of his great artwork that I think those Target front covers will forever hang in the art galleries in our minds for the rest of our lives. They're so iconic. Mm. I think I also got to know him a little. And one of the first things that came into my head was a feeling of regret, actually, that in the last couple of years I hadn't spoken to him. And it will trace it all back to 2015, where I interviewed him for the podcast and, you know, I had lunch with him, spent time and saw him working on the front covers to the Target reprints of The Visitation, Vengeance on Varos and Battlefield. He was an incredibly nice guy, but it was a difficult time for me personally because it was only 3 days earlier that my dad had passed away.
Oh, of course, yes.
And so going to Chris's home then, I was in a difficult mindset, as you would be, because I thought, well, I don't want to cancel because I'll never get this chance again. But also, I wasn't completely in the right frame of mind about it. And I actually told him, because we sort of had a cup of tea and everything before we went upstairs into his workroom. And I don't know, we just kind of spoke about it for a little bit, really. And I thought it was quite nice that he was actually showing, you know, just sort of asking questions of me. Yeah, like showing sympathy and having... it was just nice, I guess, really. And it was one of those moments when, if any of you are unlucky to have lost a parent, it doesn't actually feel that real for the first few days. And it was one of those occasions of me sort of coming to terms with it a little bit, I think, really. But it was a great boost to ultimately a very sad time. And he was really kind. He gave me a print of his artwork for the Abominable Snowmen, which is still hanging up in the office in the Hoosium.
Funnily enough, it's that simple gesture of Chris Achilleos handing you that print, that signed print of the Abominable Snowman, which, like a butterfly beating its wings, caused ripples that have changed my life for the last few years. As it was that simple act of kindness on behalf of Chris Achilleos that drove me into a jealous rage, which made me write my letter to Diddly Dum complaining about you being so jammy.
Of course!
Which led to me conversing more with Doc, which ended up with me being on here.
Oh my God.
Which has ended up with me visiting conventions and God knows what else with you guys and meeting lots of other people. Yeah, so Chris Achilleos, just that simple act of handing you that print.
Wow.
Shaped the last few years of my life. There we are. Thanks, wow. Chris.
So,
bless him.
I think what we can say about Chris Achilleos is so much to thank him for, and he's got so much to answer for.
But it was a couple of years later, I had the pleasure of interviewing him on stage at the First Capital event as well.
Oh, yes.
And I had dinner with him that night and his wife and Trevor Martin as well. And it was really good. And when I saw him at the Capital the following year, had a good catch-up and a good chat. He just always seemed friendly, and every now and then we spoke over Facebook as well. But I completely lost contact a few years ago. So when I'd heard he died, there was obviously sort of disbelief and thinking, oh no, surely not, you know. And then thinking, oh, I never got back in contact. So I was quite regretful, actually. I did think, oh, that's what a shame, you know, because it's not everyone has the chance to become an acquaintance with someone as, you know, as influential as he was and as nice as he was as well, really. Really got on well with him, and it was a big shame. Yeah, big shame.
Mm. You mentioned his wife, actually. His wife's, my sympathies to her, because I met her at Capital. She approached me outside one day when I was having a cigarette at the Capital, and just said, oh, are you here for Doctor Who? And I was like, yes, this is my first time to a convention. And she just chatted away to me. It was really nice. I said, oh, you must come over and speak to Chris. Come over and speak to him. It'll be, yeah, she was really friendly and welcoming. So that was lovely. So also, Chris's artwork. When he passed away, I mentioned to my friends, I said, Chris Kilios has passed away. And they were like, oh, that name sounds vaguely familiar. Who is that? And I said, he's an artist. And I sent them some pictures of his work. Some of it's covers and books he did for role-playing games from like the late 70s, the 80s and stuff. And a lot of the games that we all used to play together. And his artwork's on so many of those. And funnily enough, even though they're not Doctor Who fans per se, they all recognised some of his covers for the Target novelisations. Because I think even kids who are just, you know, passing Doctor Who fans in the 70s and 80s would have grown up with those popping up in their library and would have read them.
I'm just checking that our podcast 57 listeners, you can hear Hayden talking about interviewing Chris at Capitol. That was the one where you were... Hayden dines with Chris and Trevor Martin and talks about Pink Floyd. More jamminess. Wasn't that number four in your in our countdown of your top 20 jammy moments, Hayden?
It must be. It must be up there somewhere, mustn't it? And Trevor Martin talking about watching Doodlebugs go over White Hart Lane in the 40s as well. It was quite something. Oh, God. Brilliant, they were.
Doodlebugs at White Hart Lane?
Yeah.
You sure you didn't say tumbleweed?
Moving on.
Anyway, listeners, Hayden's interview with Chris, which appeared on podcast number 49, lasts for about 35 minutes. And depending entirely on how long the rest of this podcast takes, what we'll do is we'll either add it on the end of the podcast, this podcast, or if the podcast goes too long, we'll add a link to it at the end of this podcast. So yes, as Hayden says, the artwork of Chris Achilios lines the art galleries of our memories and the house of...
Here's to you, Chris.
What I thought I think was interesting about that that interview is how Chris had learned to become an artist by a technical illustration course, hadn't he? And he said that he always saw this cover artwork more as design than paintings, didn't he?
He did, yeah.
He mentions his adoration of both of Frank Bellamy and Jack Kirby, didn't he?
Yeah.
Which I think wipes out any suggestion that his Coming of Galactus tribute for Three Doctors or anything was a coincidence. Also, if you listen to the interview, you'll hear about Chris's story of how he was asked to redo some of his covers because of an apparent complaint from John Pertwee.
Yeah.
What else has been going on? Animations of lost episodes seem to be in danger, don't they?
Well, at least as far as BBC America is concerned, anyway.
Yes, I suppose so.
Yes, unfortunately, we all know what that means, don't we, chaps? It means that going forward, the only animations we're going to get is probably along the same lines as The Web of Fear.
Not adventurous, shall we say.
I saw this article, and the Daily Mirror's got quite a good track record when it comes to reporting on Doctor Who, especially with the animations. But it took me back to, I can't remember who it was, there was a YouTuber who released a video early last year who was talking, oh God, I should have done, it might have been Josh Snares actually, had sort of said in this video that he'd heard that there were only going to be another two or three with BBC America and then the deal was over. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the animations, for me,
no,
are going to be finished, because we've got to remember as well, there have been partnerships with Big Finish, of course, to do stuff like Fury from the Deep and the aforementioned Web of Fear. That was also Big Finish were involved in that one too, and Galaxy 4. And of course, I saw something on Twitter earlier today when someone said that apparently BritBox might be interested in co-funding them as well. But I think the disappointing thing is that the ones that seem to be made predominantly with BBC America, for me, are the strongest animations. And I think it's a shame that we're losing that.
Remember which ones those were?
So Evil of the Daleks, the Macra Terror, the Faceless Ones, and Power.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, well, it could well have been Josh Snares. He tweeted earlier today, 6 months ago, I predicted how the animation range would end. I am a psychic. he's not one of these psycho YouTubers, is he?
No, he's not at all. No, he's a lovely chap, I think. Right, he's great.
I Googled this and I came up with the Radio Times reporting of it, which was rather strange. It mentioned, if the report proves to be true, no doubt it will provoke an outcry from Doctor Who fans. That sounds if it's fitstering a little. It ends with, which doesn't sound like a particularly neutral point of view, the strongest way to make a case for future entries in the series would be to throw support behind upcoming edition The Abominable Snowman, which is currently scheduled for release on DVD, Blu-ray and Steelbook this year, which is either the Radio Times taking the opportunity to plug The Abominable Snowman, men, or maybe the whole story itself is an attempt to plug The Abominable Snowman so that we'll buy it in the hope that the BBC America will change their mind.
Well, yeah, I mean, also, you've got another outside production team taking over production of Doctor Who in the coming years, haven't you? So,
oh, Bad Wolf, yes, of course. Yeah.
Co-producing with BBC, whatever.
Mm.
So, I mean, is it it's possible that maybe there's something there? Or maybe they just didn't sell enough BBC America or get the ratings that BBC America wanted when they were shown in America. Who knows? Maybe it's a combination of all those things. It's just, you know, we've had very little information to go on so far, have we? We'll have to wait. And it'll be unfair of us to comment until Sue Gray's done her investigation.
I still think we could demand an apology, don't you?
Can we put an urgent question to BBC America?
Yes. I can table an urgent question at the next capital.
Well, of course, on New Year's Day, faithless listeners, we had Eve of the Daleks. the New Year's Day special from the pen of Chris Achilleos. Does that class it as a poison pen, do you think, by now?
No, you just said the poison pen of Chris Achilleos.
Oh, sorry.
Oh, no.
From the...
Jesus. People just switched off in their droves.
From the pen/poison pen of Chris Chibnall. Any initial thoughts?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've got some.
Oh, dear. Any polite thoughts?
No. Yes. Well, they're not positive. Let's just say that, to be honest.
Oi, you. No dissing my mate Chris. That's my job.
Thanks, Manchester.
That's all right, Kent.
What did you call me?
Doc, why did you just turn into Carolina Hearn just then? Hey, that's my job.
Yeah, I know.
What attracted you to the millionaire Paul Daniels?
Would anyone like to start?
Yeah, can I get it over and done with?
I'll fight you for it.
During our reviews of The Flux, I've been trying to go last so that we can build up a sort of a happy atmosphere before I come and shut it down. But...
No, sorry, Hayden could go first. I was going to say age before beauty. That doesn't work, does it?
Pearls before swine. Go on, Hayden.
So I watched this late on New Year's Day because we'd travelled back from Lincolnshire from my in-laws. Very dark, very moody. And that was just me, to be honest. I sat down and I watched it and I thought, okay, yeah, this isn't bad. This is all right. It's a lot more stripped back than I imagined it to be. You've essentially only got 5 characters being chased by a couple of Daleks in a warehouse with Mrs. Doyle poking up on the phone every now and then, and a bloke who I could barely remember was in the series before, right at the end making, you know, a cameo. Now, I think if the last couple of episodes of The Flux hadn't have happened, I might have actually quite enjoyed this. But I did on first watch, actually, that moody New Year's Day evening. I did quite enjoy it, actually. And I thought to myself, this is actually getting quite annoying now, because every time I think to myself, Chris Chibnall's dead to me.
He pulls you back in.
He pulls you back in, yeah. It's kind of like, you know, people use the analogy of like, oh, it's like a, you know, an unfaithful partner. And you keep going back to him, but, you know, you just know that that relationship's sullied. And that's just how I feel now, I think, with Doctor Who, or with this iteration of Doctor Who anyway, because even though you've got the stripped back scenario, I don't feel anything for it anymore. I just don't. It's so standard, I suppose. It's just sort of... Doctor Who to me now doesn't feel like it's doing anything that special anymore. It's just filling a space in the schedule for me.
Yeah.
Now, I love Aisling Bea. I think she's fantastic. I like her sitcom. Well, it's more of a comedy drama, really, This Way Up on Channel 4. And I think when she was there, I think her more sort of naturalistic form of acting was eclipsing the three regulars.
Oh, yeah.
And I thought actually having someone like her there, for me, actually kind of made me think, well, this more assertive character is kind of what I want to see more, I think, really, because it reminds me more of, I don't know. If Aisling Bea was the next Doctor, I'd be thrilled. Let's just put it like that. Because I thought she was the best thing in it. I did like Pauline McLean turning up on the phone every now and then. That was quite humorous. Nick was a bit creepy, wasn't he?
Well, will they stop using him for the Dalek voices?
I am not Nick.
Yeah, no, I tell you what. He's even creepier on the second watch.
Yes, he is.
Once you know that he's literally just turned up because he knows that some other bloke lets her down every New Year's Eve, so she has to work. So he knows that she's there against her wishes, having a shit night, and he's decided for the last 3 years that's when he's going to turn up because he secretly fancies her. So that first moment when she's walking around the storage place, leaving a message for Jeff on her phone, and then she turns around and he's stood there. She hasn't heard him come in, and he's just stood there staring at her with this creepy little smile on his face.
It's very stalkerish behaviour, isn't it?
Oh, it's yeah, it is, and it's just not... I don't know, Chris Chibnall, he's constantly doing this, isn't he? I think this isn't the first of the New Year's Eve specials that we've had to... the New Year's Day specials that we've complained about this. But Chris Chibnall trying to write human relationships and people's interaction therein. It's a bit like Mark Zuckerberg trying to tell you about love, isn't it? You know, it's just like, what? It just seems like he's some sort of algorithm or AI.
Oh, yes, that's a good point. Yeah.
This is how you humans interact, isn't it, when you're in love? Yes. This is all perfectly normal human behaviour, I'm sure. Yeah, Nick's just appalling. He couldn't be exterminated often enough for my liking. I didn't like him at all. I didn't like his... That bit where he's got so many girls' items in that storage space. That's extremely odd. There's no way of normalising that many relationships over however long and keeping them in storage. And a storage unit that big, that storage unit, I have a storage unit because I've had to move a couple of times over the last couple of years, and it's about 80 quid a month. And that storage unit there... that he's got, I would say, is about six times the size of mine. So that'd be like 500 quid, which would be what, like nearly $1,000 Australian or something a month. Because you don't have a storage area. You pay for size. You don't just like, oh yeah, I've got a storage area. I've just got very odd little items scattered all around it. You have to stack things. It's just nonsense. I've got distracted. What was I talking about?
Is your storage unit full of belongings to your old ex-girlfriends, Mark?
No, it's all my own stuff. And it's, funny enough, it's not a normal thing to do, is it? And like I say, to have it all sat on individual shelves like that, like it's more of a display, It's just weird. And there's no evidence that he's particularly good-hearted. Because
no.
That line, which is precision engineered to appeal to Doctor Who fandom in a way, because I think a lot of Doctor Who fandom would look at it itself and say, aren't we good-hearted weirdos loving this
oh yes,
silly little show? It was so clearly designed to, like I say, precision engineered to appeal to Doctor Who fandom. But I don't think he is a good-hearted weirdo. There's that bit where she says, this is really weird. You are weird, Ashley B says to him. You are a very weird person. And what does he do? He flounces out. And right, I'm going to kill myself then. And that is really stalkerish behaviour, because I know people who've had online dating things like that, and they've gone out with a woman, and then, or this woman has gone out with a man, and that they haven't wanted to see that person again, but that person started messaging them. And then when they've said, like, no, or they've ignored them, this person's started to say, if you don't message me back in the next hour, I'm going to kill myself. There are people like that out there. And that's what he does. He just skips straight out of that storage space to kill himself. And even then, it's already been ascertained that he's in a time loop and he'd come back. So, again, it's like an empty threat. I didn't like him at all.
Very stalkerish behaviour. I mean, we've all done it, but... I actually got more pleasure from this story than anything since Rosa or Witchfinders.
Wow.
I think, because there were at least a dozen punch-the-air moments for me in this story. Mostly of the cast getting exterminated over and over again.
I was going to say, was this...
The Doctor, Yaz and Dan all getting his... Oh, at once. Ah! It was almost the opposite experience of Christmas Carol for me, because I remember that I loathed on Christmas Day, watched again on Christmas... on New Year's Day. And ever since that, I've thought it one of the... certainly still the finest Christmas special ever and one of the best stories ever. But with this, I quite enjoyed it on New Year's Day. I mean, still, only relatively. But I remember thinking when I rewatched it last night in preparation for this podcast, that it was Bobbins. And I think if there isn't a decent story, then I have to care about the characters. Mm. And I wonder if, having watched it once and known what was coming, the plot couldn't grip me anymore, and so I was relying more on the characters. I suppose it's some achievement, really, having produced a TARDIS crew without one personality between them. They go and add two new characters to the fam, or one at least of whom lacks a personality. The other of whose personality seems to rely mainly on saying Mammy a lot. Although I will admit she was far more naturalistic and lively than the rest of them.
Yeah. I was going to say, I think it's the naturalistic sort of depiction that did it for me.
Apart from the occasional fall into naturalism, Dan continues to be as wooden as Aunt Sally. He completely gets that line wrong, Manx.
Manx. You hear Manx? Don't you understand?
There's his line, oi, who are you calling inferior?
The inferior human is correct.
Who are you calling inferior?
Followed by, you've got to look at this. Find this if you're watching this again. When Dan says, oi, who are you calling inferior? He immediately follows it by a sideways glance at the Doctor, which is so painfully unnaturalistic as to make Adric's walking seem almost nonchalant by comparison.
Ooh! Ow!
This is this strange relationship between Dan and Yaz. I wonder if it's intended to be heartwarmingly friendly, but... Someone slags him off and she says, oh, you, no dissing my mate, that's my job.
Are you? No dissing my mate, that's my job.
Thanks, Sheffield.
And he says, oh, thanks, Sheffield. But I don't think you get the impression at all that they have that sort of... Well, I'm not sure you get the impression they have any relationship at all, Yaz and Dan. But this idea that they're great pals together, I don't get it. Especially when you consider they're supposed to have been travelling the world with each other for 4 years.
Can I just say again, that's another one of those things that's a very Chibnall thing, isn't it? That he tells you they're great pals and they say, we're great pals.
Yeah.
And at the end of the Flux story, Dan says, Yaz has been amazing all these years.
Yes.
And it's just like, right, oh, you just have to presume it because there's nothing in their actions or behaviour that seems to say it on screen. It's just...
I mean, you feel that Yaz might have a personality. It's just that 3 years in, I feel we're still waiting to see it. And this is why I don't want to sound callous, but this is why I really couldn't care less about this supposed unspoken romance that's been going on between her and the Doctor. And as for the question of whether Yaz will tell the Doctor about her feelings for her, to be interested in that, I'd really have to care what the Doctor's reply is. There'd be no particular warm glow for me if the Doctor had said, "Oh, and I love you too," any more than there would be a feeling of sadness if the Doctor said, "Oh, well, let's just remain good friends." What I thought was interesting is, I think everyone assumes, don't they? If Yaz says to the Doctor, "I've got these feelings for you, I love you," the Doctor must either reciprocate or must do what she did when Graham brought his cancer problem to her.
Yeah.
And yes. Just say, yes. I can't handle this sort of human emotion. But if they went the other way and did what they had Bill doing throughout season 10, actually pushing people away. Well, she's in Knock Knock, and one of the characters is, she's going to her bedroom, and the character says, "Just call me if you need any of my help, won't you?" And she says, "Look, I get that you're into me, but you're not my type. I tend to go for girls, you see." Or if the Doctor says to her, "Well, I like women too, but I tend to go for my own age and species, love." That scene in Eaters of Light where the Roman soldiers, one of them said, "Lucius fancies you." And Bill says, "Sorry, Lucius, I ought to explain. This is going to be probably a really difficult idea for you. I don't like men that way." I mean, there's no way they'll ever have a Doctor doing that. I thought it might be amusing. I must say, I thought at the time, as satisfying as that was to see Bill being hoist with her own petard, as it were, and having come across as the person who's out there, to get dismissed as being narrow-minded, Ronan Munro goes on to get it completely wrong, because, of course, while it's true that the Romans weren't that fussed about whether men did it with women or with other men, or both, that relaxed attitude depended entirely on who was doing the, shall we say, the penetrating.
I see, yeah.
Because the man who was, shall we say, playing the part of the fielder rather than the batsman wasn't thought, "Oh, yeah, you go, good for you." He was considered to be the woman in the relationship and therefore beneath contempt.
So the other Roman soldiers most likely wouldn't care less if Marcus was screwing Lucius. But they despise Lucius for it.
But even Dan got competition in the dullness stakes with Nick, who was, I just thought, he says at one point, doesn't he, the Dalek, "You can't beat a Rasta, you know." And you think, I know Rastas, and none of them are as dull and interesting as this guy.
He can't deliver, I mean, it's not much of a line to deliver, but like his comedy line as well, it's like, "I'm trying to work out which is most unlikely, killer robots or the council working on New Year's Eve." God.
And which Sarah had herself just made that joke about 5 seconds before, didn't she?
Exactly.
Very strange. But having said all that, I found that I couldn't keep up my litany of moaning as I've done for the last 3 years about Jodie's acting, because finally, 3 years in, she was showing up quite a bit of vocal and physical nuance in her acting in this. I mean, everything's relative. I feel as if we've reached the point now, as I say, where Adric walking believably would count as an improvement in the acting. It's not amazing, but it's a huge step up. The penguin arms have stopped.
Yeah.
Making a point by just moving her arms out sideways. And there's a lot of some nuance into the delivery of lines. Bit late. I mean, what is there, 2 episodes left? Less clunky dialogue as well. Apart from, "The Dalek will kill everything not within its own image." That's not even English.
That would seem like an odd thing to say, didn't it? For some reason, I started thinking, is that something to do with Weeping Angels?
Yeah.
I mean, I couldn't. I was like, oh no, wait a second, what?
And that's for Yaz's lie.
"And we know there's a stash of toxic and combustive materials on the fifth floor."
I mean, see, it'll probably take me a good 5 minutes to construct that sentence, let alone deliver it. But I thought, plot-wise, it was a pretty decent story, I thought.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, my criticism of it is more in the fact that I'm just fed up of this era. Yeah. I'd say. I mean, I did enjoy it on first watch, and I watched it the second time, which I haven't actually done much during Jodie's era, because Series 11 was such a trudge for me. I don't want to put myself through it every week. So I went back and watched it again here. But it's just, it's the era. It's just, I'm done with it. Like I said, I've kind of made up in my head at the end of the Vanquishers that this hasn't really done it for me. There's been some good episodes, some that I've really enjoyed. But it just feels all just a little bit, I don't know, it feels dead to me now, really. I was pleased that they addressed the Doctor trying to wipe out the Daleks in The Vanquishers, because I hated that when she tried to commit mass genocide against
a few
species. Well, yeah, and she did, sorry, yes.
As far as we're... I mean, because at that point, they were the survivors of the race,
yes,
weren't they?
Yes, they were.
I mean, here, they've downgraded it to just being a war fleet.
Yes, yeah.
But it was literally the survivors of the Dalek race at the end of the Flux, so I don't know. I wonder if Chris Chibnall had second thoughts and maybe actually that makes it sound like she's committed genocide. So he thought he'd try and dial it back in this one by saying it was just a work get-together, it wasn't a genocide. I mean, sorry, it was just a destroying a battle fleet.
Well, we're waiting for what Sue Gray makes of it.
What Sue Gray's review of the Flux says.
I did like the Daleks' new guns.
I quite like the Daleks' new guns, yeah. But when Dan was belittling the Dalek and the Dalek's shooting at him and he's just moving to the side, I just thought, Jesus, why has no one else done that for the last 57 years?
Well, unfortunately, I don't think the Dalek's middle has rotated independently since series one, has it? So,
that's true. Yeah. That's very true.
Yeah, but see, that would be like, that would almost seem like a Dalek going upstairs moment, wouldn't it? If Dan was doing that and going, ho, 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 and then suddenly went, its middle just rotated round. They'd be like, oh, crap.
Well, I'd have preferred that, though.
Perhaps we finally got justification for the Paradigm Daleks. But if they'd been that here, there wouldn't be room to get round them in the corridor, would there?
That is true.
No. I didn't like any of that stuff with Dan. It was far too much of a... This whole last series in particular, and perhaps most of other bits of Chibnall's era, but that last series and this story, I think it feels like the first truly post-Marvel universe Doctor Who. Because I think there's a lot of nuance has gone out the window. And like you get those scenes like just before Dan goes downstairs where he like turns around and he's got this big hero moment and he's like, yeah, well, you saved the universe a week ago, so I guess I owe you one. And it's just like, it's so cheesy. It comes across as very comic book, it seems to me. It comes across very much like the sort of thing you'd read. It's quite cartoonish. I found this story very cartoonish, like a lot of Jodie's mannerisms and the way she sort of did these huge, big... I thought her acting was terrible in this, far too over the top for me. Huge, big... movements and like the bit where she's looking at her watch and then when she's doing a long speech and chopping her arms about again and going two Daleks one phone and stuff like that and then looking really seriously and angrily at the Dalek as
what did she say again Mark
huh
what did she say again
No, I'm not repeating it for you.
Sorry, it's on.
Don't interrupt me. and then she's staring down the camera like in a real kind of icky, smug, mean way that I don't know why it really... When I first saw it, it wound me up and I didn't like it the second time round. And that the people sort of fall into a V-shape behind her as the camera pulls back and everyone's sort of like... A bit like a sort of Avengers Assemble moment. And it just found it too cheesy, really, for me. I hated all that stuff. And like I say, Dan's hero stuff and going down with his... one box to say, yeah, I've got some stuff to put away. I don't know, I can't do accents, sorry. Yeah, I don't know. And he knows he's probably going to come back. I mean, nobody wants to get exterminated, but it's not such a big deal if you think you're just going to reappear, is it, really?
Excuse me, Mark. Exterminated.
Oh, God, that's a joke as well.
That's when you realise, but not when you realise... with the Lupari, was that whole thing about Nick having all these ex-girlfriends entirely to feed that pun line? And was the whole think about the Lupari being pair bonded entirely to feed the lion about a man's best friend.
Yeah. No, exactly. He's just reverse engineers. He thinks of a punchline and then reverse engineers his way from it. And it's just...
What do you think about the first post-Marvel Doctor, Mark? Do you mean post-Marvel as in, oh, we finally got over Marvel, here's something new? Or post-Marvel as in, this is clearly been affected by Marvel?
Marvel's taken over, yeah.
Well, the second?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the latter. This is like, what's big today? What's does the rounds? I think this is one of the most internet fandom aware eras as well. I think a lot of this is, like I said before about the good-hearted weirdos, I think a lot of this is precision engineered for memes, and it's to appeal to the very vocal sort of fandom that swoons and gets really excited on and who sort of live their lives through social media and stuff. That sounds rude and harsh, but I think that's a big influence on the show. And obviously Marvel has exactly that sort of huge online fandom. And I think there's so much of this, like Hayden mentioned it before when we were talking about the Flux, and it's just, it's the first, I think it's the first of the docs here. When Stephen Moffat did a sort of wry look at, like, oh, we've done a kind of Marvel thing, it was the return of Dr. Mysterio, wasn't it?
Yes,
and, you know, which was more of a hark back to the first Superman film, really. But this is just seems to be big, cheesy hero moments. I mean, it seems to have even more slow motion running and stuff. Like, they look really, did you notice, like, Dan and Yaz, like, you've got to protect that guy and save his life. And they're, like, real sort of determined slow motion running and stuff. And it's just, it doesn't feel like Doctor Who. I don't like this flavour of Doctor Who.
I have quite a strange relationship with Marvel because it's something I think, oh God, no. At the same time, I've not watched any of it. I've seen, what's the one where they were in Africa?
Black Panther.
Black Panther, yeah.
You sound quite quiet, Hayden. Have you moved away from your microphone?
No, I think my voice is going a bit.
Finally. No, you know, I don't really
know. And with that, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah.
Was Black Panther Marvel?
Yes.
Yes, yeah. I saw that. Now, I like that a lot.
Oh, I love the Marvel Universe.
I thought the plot was tedious and belief, but I like the, you know, the whole Africanizing of it, you know, the fabrics and the designs and that sort of thing. But apart from, I mean, I watched something like, was it Avengers Assemble?
It's the first Avengers film.
Or one of them, where it just seems to me that you've got people like the Hulk, and effectively these invulnerable superheroes, and you bring a skyscraper down on top of the Hulk or something, and you know he's going to just, after a couple of seconds, he'll burst out of it unharmed. And you think, well, they're actually not... The only reason they're doing that is it's for the cinematic image of a skyscraper falling on top of him. No one actually believes for a second. Yes, I know that the Doctor is effectively immortal, isn't he? But when we saw him getting shot by the Dalek in season 3, was it?
Yes.
Just before he regenerated into Rosie's dildo. You thought, oh my God, didn't you? And it just doesn't get me. And there's far too much... I eventually got even tired about the X-Men films. Because that's where it seems to end the same way. I mean, effectively, Magneto, who I do think is the coolest one in all of it, is the Loki of the X-Men films, isn't he? Because he's someone who arrives in a really bad mood resenting people, does something outrageous to take over, ends up getting defeated, and then they just let him off. Usually with in Magneto's case, sort of saying over his shoulder, they'll never accept you as one of them, Charles, before he leaves. You think, it's the third or fourth time I've seen this. So I can't quite bring myself to watch this Loki series that people have been banging on about.
Oh, Hawkeye's really good. I've just finished watching Hawkeye. Excellent.
Hawkeye, yeah, I've enjoyed.
Really good. Hawkeye and WandaVision are my two favourites, I would say.
Which one's Hawkeye?
Hawkeye's just new. He's the bow and arrow guy.
Oh, I don't even know. I'm just aware of that.
Yeah, that's, I can concur. And also, recently I saw Spider-Man No Way Home, which I thought was fantastic.
This is the latest thing that's come out just for Christmas.
It is, yeah.
Hmm.
But is that worth a watch?
Yeah. Yeah, I loved it. I don't. Have you seen it, Mark?
Yeah, I really want to see that. No, I wouldn't see it. I'd say, when I say post-Marvel and stuff, I'm criticising them using those sort of tropes and it being an influence on Doctor Who.
No.
It doesn't mean I actually dislike the Marvel films or the TV series. I really do like them. But I do think they're...
It's very obvious.
Yeah, to me, it feels like a very obvious over-influence on the series, but...
I'm not for 1 minute saying that I think the Marvel Cinematic Universe is rubbish. I don't think much of it, but therefore I don't bother to watch it. But if they're now trying to write Doctor Who that way, because they think that's the way to win popularity, then I will speak out.
Who's playing Spider-Man in this one?
Tom Holland is.
Oh, right. Is he strong?
Is he strong?
Listen, bud, he's got radioactive blood.
Oh,
right. Can he swing from a thread?
Just take a look overhead.
Oh, look out!
Da, 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 da.
Don't start singing that, otherwise people will start thinking that we're talking about something they can't hear.
Oh, hang on.
Oh.
Computer, can you open the... Oh, that's... Oh, no. Right. Oh, thank you. Oh, and those just broke up a magnum.
Do you feel lucky, punks? Well, do you?
Come away from the window, Doc. On the whole, I've really enjoyed the Marvel films and the Marvel TV series.
Mm.
But the problem I have is that Doctor Who, I think, has always worked best when it's setting the trends, not when it's following them.
Yes.
And I think that's starting to happen now, where it's like, hey, this is popular, let's do that.
Yeah.
And that's unfortunate.
What's the one thing we've been saying about Jodie's era? Oh, the visuals are amazing.
Hmm.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's Guardians of the Galaxy Marvel.
Yep.
Yes.
That's where I stopped watching. I enjoy the first one. It's the one where they've got the little thing that's like a little
raccoon.
Tiny kid. Yeah. When I watched the second one, and it does that thing where it becomes towards the end. You know the bit in the first Star Trek movie where it's interminably the Enterprise passing through this bloody cloud? And it's clearly something going for, the best computer animation Oscar or something. And that's how Guardians of the Galaxy 2 ends. I just can't watch any of this again. I did see Wonder Woman, though.
That's DC.
Oh, have I just committed a faux pas?
I'm just using Marvel as a shorthand, really. DC's not had quite so much luck. Wonder Woman film was good, though, I thought.
And Shazam.
What do you think of, I've been torn between, you know this whole Daleks do not have managers? Daleks do not store stuff. I'm torn between that, because I want to think that's not how Daleks talk. You know, I think Russell started it with, this is pest control. Would you, Daleks wouldn't say that. Well, I liked when in Bad Wolf in Series 1, when they first realised, oh my God, it's the Daleks. On the edge of the solar system, they turn up. They say to him, he says, oh, what are you going to do? And they said, we've captured your friend. And of course, they're Daleks. They don't say we've captured your friend.
I will talk to the doctor.
Oh, will you? That's nice. Hello.
The Dalek stratagem nears completion. The fleet is almost ready. You will not intervene.
Oh, really? Why is that then?
We have your associate. You will obey, or she will be exterminated!
because we have your associate. Which I think, oh, that's very Daleky there. But having said that, as irritating it is, I am not Nick. Daleks don't have managers. Daleks don't store stuff. I do worry that if they were more correct and write them more as I think Daleks ought to be written, it would make them quite boring. So I'm not too sure about that. Has it all quite worked out the point of this guy, Carl, from the train on Woman Who Fell to Earth re-emerging at the end of the episode?
Again, this is that, strikes me as that kind of slightly Marvel thing, like characters from earlier films and things up here, and you quite often get a post-credits sequence with an old character turning up and things. And again, I just think it's that. I think that's just flavour of the day, and I think it's a bit of fan service.
To be honest, it's one of the most surprising cameos. I thought I'd have been more surprised if the beekeeper from Delta and the Bannerman turned up again. Instead of that guy, that would have been on the same level.
Yeah, this is a bit of a random thing. I mean, I had no idea. It was only when I saw online afterwards that he was the same guy. I didn't watch it and go, oh my God, it's him. And to be honest, I think only people who've rewatched The Woman Who Fell to Earth several times and watched it fairly recently, like in the last few months, would probably remember him, surely. So it's definitely one for the hardcore fans of this era, I think.
I couldn't work out who he was, but when I saw later on, I think probably the next day, online, oh, it's that guy from, and I'm not sure I paid attention to which episode they were referring. Do you know who I thought it was? I thought it was the annoying security guard who got killed when he was saying, I've got the fastest fingers in the north. At least that's what my boyfriend says. And your first reaction was, kill him now. You know where there was the reaction afterwards? They're always killing off the gays in Doctor Who. The truth is, no, they're not. They're just inserting gay characters just to get kudos. And because they can't be bothered to write, well, maybe not until recently, because they can't bother to write them properly, gay characters will usually just be a throwaway character, and the throwaway characters mainly exist to be killed off, don't they?
Yeah, well, I mean, to be honest as well, again, I'm always accusing Chris Chibnall of being lazy, which probably sounds very harsh, but his representation in the stories is good, but quite often he does, it's the phrase, bury the gays or something.
Oh, that's it, yeah.
And this thing with Yaz, yes, Yaz has pretty much, certainly in the last couple of series, I'd say, she's does sort of stand around looking a bit doe-eyed at Jodie's doctor. But I've never taken that means that there's something sexual going on. She's just looking at an amazing person and going, oh, you're so great. And so, you know, it does feel like Chibnall's doing this, oh, yeah, now it's a gay companion doctor romance without putting in the work. And it's like he did with Joe Martin's doctor. Oh, I've cast the first black doctor. Everyone, look, here we are. Yeah. And she gets a few minutes of screen time every few episodes. Brilliant. I think the best thing about Chris Chibnall has been his diversity hiring behind the scenes and in front of the camera. And that's been the best thing about his era, I think. But a lot of his other stuff, I think it's just, he does it too cheaply. And I still think, if I can move off that subject and go on to like his plots again, you know how like the Flux plots had to get Jodie onto the division headquarters thing so she could have a conversation with Tecton. There's loads of illogical things, and Tecton was saying stuff that didn't make sense with stuff that she'd said earlier, and it was like, it doesn't really fit together. It doesn't make sense why Doctor's been put there, and it's just because that's where Chris Chibnall wants it to go. He can't actually work out a decent reason for it to happen. And this time loop's just, it's all over the place. It's like a first draft, and it's like he has this great idea. Yeah, there'd be a time loop. And what happens is this, and then that person goes there. And then if you look at the plotting of it, it doesn't really work. But it's like he's lost interest, and he's got really excited about the concept, and he just can't be bothered to tidy it up and make it work properly. So you get the Doctor halfway through saying something about having to get out of the time loop before it ends at midnight. At what point has anyone said the time loop? At that point, the Doctor doesn't even know the TARDIS is causing the time loop.
Yes, that was strange, isn't it?
I mean, and nobody human has made it to the end of the time loop, if there is an end of the time loop, how do we know there is? Because nobody human survives past being exterminated by the Daleks.
That was a weird thing as well, wasn't it? Sarah saying, oh, Nick doesn't survive past 5 to 12.
Yeah.
Therefore, if he dies again, he'll never appear again. She said, yeah. It's like, who was it? The woman who eventually dumps Dan for not keeping the date. Diana, was it?
Diane.
How she suddenly becomes an expert in space time theory towards the end of the flux.
Yeah, and halfway through the episode, Sarah, Ashley B's character, says, so there's a door that doesn't have a force field on it out the back. And it's like, well, why did the Daleks not put a force field on that door? I don't know. Anyway, it doesn't make sense. And them reappearing in the same spot, but minutes later.
You never really tell, can you, whether it's because Chris Chibnall has written it badly, or whether it all did actually all fit together, but it's been haphazardly edited. You know, and there was an explanation for this, and there was an explanation for that, but just God knows what happened to it.
But this happens repeatedly, and it's one of the reasons that I get so annoyed with the Chris Chibnall era. If I was invested in the main characters and cast, if I enjoyed Jodie's performance as the Doctor, which I don't,
yeah,
like you, I found Dan's acting terribly wooden in this episode. I found it bizarre that his best friend for years has just come out to him, and then as soon as they turn their back, he's saying to the Doctor, hey, they fancy you. But Dan's performance, John Bishop's performance, rubbish. Yaz's character, just, she did have a bit to do in here. Like, you know, the coming out scene to Dan was, you know, probably the most acting, I think, that Mandy Gills had to do. But if you don't care about the main characters...
I thought it was interesting where Dan asked, how have you told her? Oh, how you told the Doctor how you feel about her? I don't know what you mean. Oh, yes, you do. And Yaz says, is it that obvious? No, it's not obvious. You never express it. I think compared to this great romance, by comparison, the relationship between Leela and Andred was signposted right from the beginning of Face to Fear.
And that's the problem, I think, with this Chris Chibnall era. If the TARDIS team had chemistry and their dialogue popped and stuff, you know, like, take season 6, which is one of my favourite seasons, the second Doctor, Jamie, Zoe. One of the reasons I love the War Games so much is because it's just them just romping through, and the chemistry between them, it's great. And I care about them. And I just haven't felt that throughout Chris Chibnall's era at all. So there's nothing to carry me through the episodes when there's all these glaring potholes. Potholes? Plot holes.
Potholes.
I think you make a really good point about the representation, because... You know what you were saying about Mark Zuckerberg? Mr. Spock saying anger? Oh, yes, one of your human emotions. That there's representation, but it's almost like doing it by numbers. Yes, I have put in X number of gay characters, trans characters, black characters, British Asian characters, whatever. I have put in the first female Doctor. I guess there'll be people who obviously will have their own views on this, but none who will be great figures that most of us will remember after this is over. I struggle to understand sometimes how people can say, oh, Ryan's amazing, Yaz is amazing. Mm. And is it just that they're, having grown up in this era of TV, their idea of what makes... of what a character can be in a drama is so low. Their idea of drama is watching Hollyoaks. And so they think, oh, this is isn't, aren't they amazing?
I think there's like a desire to be a fan rather than being genuinely infused. Yeah. I think there's a certain element of, I want to belong to a group. I like belonging to this group of people who all say, isn't this amazing? You know, nobody wants to belong to our group where we say, isn't this you know, because it's boring.
We know that no one wants to join our group because no one's written to us since Mark wrote us that email. How many years ago was that?
6 years ago.
You see, I think the title whatever the story is telling. Eve of the Daleks. Now, that suggests to me that it's that what he's doing there is he's saying, I'll never be able to let anyone again say Evil of the Daleks without thinking of my story. Because how many times are people going to mix that up now? Did you say Evil or Eve? And I think that shows a sort of, okay, I could be my prejudice against him. Could easily be making me to get that wrong. But if you want to be remembered in Doctor Who, do it by creating amazing characters, amazing dramatic moments, amazing stories. Don't do it by just doing things that we can't avoid. There's a different way to be remembered, which is actually doing writing, like Robert Holmes or Mac Hulk or someone. I don't know. You have a marvellous opportunity. You're given the show. And this is what's always made me worry about. You know when people are giving the suggestion that he never wanted to do it in his heart? It was almost forced on him. I never understood that. How could it be? He'd just done, well, relatively recently had done Broadchurch. Yeah. He's got amazing plaudits. He must have had so much kudos for that. There must have been people offering him, you know, oh, yeah, we must get Shishiko to do as a story. He didn't want to do Doctor Who. There's no way he had to do it. And it just seems to have been a waste of so much. You have the first female Doctor, and you find yourself in a situation where you're having to say, they'll have to make the 14th Doctor a woman as well, because otherwise people might think the BBC's made it about being a man, because clearly being a woman was a dreadful mistake. The way to avoid doing that is making the first female Doctor an utterly amazing experience for us all. And then people won't be saying, it's got to be a woman the next time. They're going to say, oh, how can anyone match this? Instead of which, we'll get one of the rare companions of colour. That's what I was about, I'd never start using that expression. In the TARDIS, and they're just meaningless. You've got a guy who is best known for doing game shows, and he's, okay, I'm not saying I'll always remember Graham, but he's fairly effortlessly a personality, isn't he? Not maybe because he's a generation or so older than Mandip and
Toyson.
And so he's already worked out what his personality is or how to act a personality. But I just think it's very, very disappointing. And there's this thing that who was the guy that you crowbarred into your Christmas quiz about people called Stephen? Was it Matt Strevens?
Oh, Matt Strevens.
Who's supposed to have said pre Jodie's debut? I must admit, I don't remember him saying this, but I've read it, so I assume people are telling the truth. Chris has great LGBT plans for the series. Now, whether it's just that those never occurred, or whether he was planning all along. Do you think he was planning all along to have something between Jodie and the Doctor?
No, I'm not convinced. I thought that, I mean, I don't know, I'm not sure where I heard it, but I thought that there was supposed to be, so like Ryan and Yasmin was supposed to be a thing, but then maybe there wasn't the chemistry there. And then I have to say I was misdirected towards the start of The Flux when I thought there was more in in Yasmin's look at Vinda when Vinda first appeared in front of her. And I thought there was more chemistry there than there was between, even though Yasmin had What Would the Doctor Do written on her hand.
Yeah.
I still thought there was more chemistry with her and Vinda in those first few opening scenes. It looked like they were kind of checking each other out. I don't know, unless that was deliberate misdirection.
Maybe the Sea Devils will save us all. I must say I did like how they've not screwed around with the Sea Devils design, as they've done with the Santarans and the Salurians, and they really looked like, I mean, it sort of saved the Sea Devils from the atrocity that was Warriors from the Deep, isn't it? From the deep? Of the deep?
From the deep.
Warriors well,
from
most the deep. Of their most of their heads are sort of lolling on one side. It looked really cool.
I just find it very hard to, you know, it's nice to see the Sea Devils back, but I think I'm just at a point now where I find it really hard to be excited about anything. Unless it's going to be the next episode that Chris Chibnall doesn't have anything to do with, to be honest. I think I'm, like Hayden said, this era's just worn me down.
Sea Devils look so amazing, but I just cannot rid myself of the idea that we'll find out their weaknesses, they're addicted to Nutella or something. Oh, hazelnuts. Well, this is unusual, isn't it? Me and Mark hogging the conversation and Hayden not coming a word in. Imagine you've been dying quietly in the background. Any other thoughts, Hayden?
Are you okay, Hayden?
My final words will be friends, Romans.
Countrymen.
I know. Oh, what's the news?
There was the really good joke at the end, though, wasn't there?
Was there?
When we found that the TARDIS had rebuilt itself into exactly the same.
Oh, yeah.
The Doctor's line was, it's so much better.
I know, when she walked in and they all stand there like with their eyes open in amazement and she goes, oh, look at that. And then I thought, oh, great, what's the TARDIS going to look like? And it's just the same. Oh, no.
I suppose he wasn't going to, was it? He couldn't change it.
No.
I've still never forgiven him for getting rid of the whole mezzanine control room of Capaldi's era. That and the old version of the first Doctor's TARDIS that they resurrected in... was it Adventure in Space and Time, or am I thinking of the one that the Ruth Doctor had? Are the finest two examples of the... And it's not just it looks lousy. You have to say... was it Michael Pickwood who designed the... Who designed the Capaldi era one with the little sort of mezzanine floor on the edge of the TARDIS, which was designed so well because all you have to do is you stand up on that little bit where you've got the things like bookcases and you've instantly almost doubled or trebled the number of potential number of shots you've got. If you wanted to have the Doctors in the TARDIS and have that, you know, the helicopter things at the top of the console going around in the ceiling, normally you'd have to, the cameraman would have to crouch down on his knees and look upwards. But if you got the Doctor up on those stairs, they could do it. That was a lovely, and I never really understood why they get away with this, that a new showrunner comes in and they feel, right, I've got to have a new Doctor, I've got to have a new companion because I can't possibly work with something, though, that one of my predecessors has done. I've got to have a new TARDIS. Yeah, if you're going to do it, at least make it look good. And what do we get? We get a little narrower space in which the Doctor can just operate the console. And then we usually have the companions sitting on some steps near the door, don't we? There's no other visuals in that design. So I suspect that this era will go down as a wasted opportunity.
Yeah, I feel like that. But I also... Funny enough, I think it's also going to generate some of the most fervent sort of fanhood and fan behaviour as well, because that quite often seems to happen when you get an era that's so reviled. Like, bless Colin Baker, but he's got some of his fans of his, let's say his era's not the most beloved, is it, generally? But the people who are fans of his era are, like, really...
Yeah, fervent.
Like, yeah. Hardcore. Yeah. Like,
yes.
Mm. And that feels a lot like what's happened with this Chibnall era as well, is that it's generally, it's not been a great era, but it's got some really incredibly fervent...
acolytes, yeah.
Yes.
Right, I think that once that's edited down,
and if we remove Hayden's 45-minute passionate defence of Chris Chibnall,
there'll be plenty of room for a 35-minute interview by one of our foremost fan interviewers and Chris Achilleos. So, any idea where we could get hold of one?
Oh.
Have we anything else to like to say?
No. I mean, it's, apart from giving a mark, I'm pretty...
Give me a number out of 10. 10 being woohoo, 1 being...
So, marks out of 10? I would give it a 6.
Quah! You love it!
Mark?
I'll give it 4. To be honest, it's probably better than some episodes that I've scored higher than it, but I think I'm suffering fatigue from this era now and kind of just want it to be over. So I can't muster more than 4 points for it tonight.
Hayden?
I'm probably going to sit in the middle of you two, I reckon, and go for a 5.
No, we can't ever have me giving the highest scores or something.
Oh, Doc, you're such a fanboy. Oh.
You've really changed your tune, Doc. You really have.
Wow. New year, new Doc.
Well, in that case, faith sisters, if you wait until we say goodbye, we will add on Hayden's interview with Chris Achilleos from 2016. And we'll now say goodbye. And, look who it is. It's Uncle Terence. Uncle Terence, happy new year to you.
Thank you very much, Doc. Thank you very much.
Have you anything to say to the faithless listeners as we begin our journey through 2022?
Only to continue what I've been saying for the last 5 years, and that is do not dump bodies in the weather.
Uncle Terence, we have enemy ships in Sector 27.
It's a trap.
Bye-bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Okay, so I'm here with Chris Achilleos, the original Doctor Who Target cover artist and well-known fantasy artist. Hello, Chris. How are you?
Oh, hello. I'm okay, thank you.
So, obviously, here today, we're here to talk primarily about the Target covers from, obviously, the 1970s and beyond. Right. But how did you become involved with the Target book range? And did you have to pitch your work to get the gig at all? Or?
No, I was just asked one day. I was presented with these 3 new book covers to do. And I already knew the program anyway. So I thought, wow, okay. So I did a rough for the first one, which was a zombie, I believe. And they sent it back saying, because I drew all these realistic guns. I had some crap reference photographs that were no good, so I made up my own hands and things, and they sent it back saying, no, this would not do at all. We need to have our own creatures shown on there. So I went back and redid it again with, as it turned out, with the proper reference material. That started it all, really. Yeah.
Yeah. And they were the reprints, weren't they, from 3 books which were originally.
I didn't know that. I didn't know that until quite recently.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it was Doctor Who and the Daleks, Doctor Who and the Crusaders, and Doctor Who and the Zabi that were the first 3.
Yeah. First 3 to do. Yeah. For some reason, I think I did the rough for the Zabi first.
Mm.
And but that established the concept, really.
Mm.
Of and I followed through what Bellamy was doing
right. Okay.
With the dot technique, which I used anyway, having done the technical illustration course at college.
Mm.
And I knew very well. So I carried on doing the Doctor Who's head in dots and surrounding him with all these special effects, showing the creatures, you know, which was sometimes very difficult because there was no reference to be seen at all, hardly.
Mm.
So, but I referred to my memory of the show because I used to watch it then, and so I knew the stories. So I didn't read any synopsis of the stories at all. So I just got on with them, you know.
Yeah.
But after a while, I even stopped. They didn't ask for roughs, you know, and I didn't give them any. I just used to get the title, and the rest was up to me.
All right, okay.
I just go and do it and deliver it in time, always in time.
Mm. And how long did it usually take to come up with the vision for the artwork of the novels?
I used to allow myself a week to do them in, because I was very busy then working all the time in mainly fantasy and some advertising stuff. So I had deadline after deadline chalked up on the calendar.
Mm.
And I couldn't be late with anything. So I allowed myself a week to do them in. So a day or so to work out the design, the layout, which was the most creative part of it, I suppose, because you get all the elements in. They gave me an address in London where I used to go as part of the BBC, and I used to go and ask for reference.
Mm.
And they point to a metal cabinet, and it's full of files in there with all the titles, and I would go there, and it would be like three or four stills, black and white stills there. And, you know, if you get one that was all right, you'd be lucky, you know, for reference.
Mm.
It was like that. So I suppose a day when going to London for that. And then to just get on with it, draw it, and then dot it, you know, draw it with a pen and dot it. Mm. And a final day for colouring it. And then another day trip to London to deliver it to the publishers, which was always fun, you know. They always made a fuss of me, and because I was making them a fortune at the time, and they didn't tell me that, and saving the company from bankruptcy. But anyway, just mention a word for that. Yeah.
I mean, but so was there ever any challenges with the colourisation then? Because if you're doing them from black and white stills, and you're having to reference from memory as well.
The colour, I mean, yeah, the colour was obvious because I did a red TARDIS on the first one, Doctor and the Daleks, you know, for some reason, yeah, I decided to paint it in that colour because it suited the composition, I don't know. But I should have known better because there was still police boxes around the streets then. But there you go, that's how it goes. But the creatures, you know, you just make them up. I mean, the Daleks, I didn't know if they were coloured or not.
Mm.
Even their true shapes, you know, I couldn't find any decent reference from them. That was in the very early books. Later on, there was more and more references to be found.
Mm-hmm.
The Loch Ness Monster was a difficult one, I remember, because all they had was a Polaroid picture of the monster. Tiny Polaroid picture, yeah.
Of the Scarecin, yeah.
Yeah. Okay,
yeah.
Of the head and neck of that, tiny like this.
Mm.
So I had to rely on the big ring of rainbow colours that went round the doctor's, you know, a big doctor's head and then surrounded by this glow of colours.
Mm.
I was always conscious of them, that they're book covers, you see, to attract attention.
Yeah.
And that's what I was good at, because I used to design books as well, do the layout and design the lettering and everything.
Mm.
So I knew they have to be punchy and immediately attracted to the passerby. And so I stuck this very bright ring of colours around it.
I mean, I can vouch for that, because as a 7 or 8 year old walking into the bookshops and buying these Target books, yeah, I was always attracted by the front covers as well. And also, obviously, the doctor on the front. If it's a doctor I didn't like, then I could forget about it.
Yeah.
So I remember the Cybermen front cover was one that really stuck out.
Yeah, I like the design of that as well. Mm. See, they are very clean designs.
Yeah.
You know, this is why I still like them. They are concept graphic designs, you know. They're not real paintings as such.
No.
They are what they are, book covers. And the Cyberman, you know, that one. It's a great cover.
But what was the difference through the techniques that you used for the front cover and also the inside illustrations with the early...
Oh, don't mention those. No. They were rubbish. I was forced to do them, really. I was like, oh, you must do them, Chris, you know.
Mm.
We must have inside illustrations. So I tried it at first, and then I just put my foot down. I said, no, I'm not doing them anymore.
Mm.
If I wanted to be a comic strip artist, I would have been a comic strip artist.
Yeah, that's different.
Yeah, I'm not that. You know, I'm something else.
And you mentioned this dotting technique.
Yeah.
And you picked that up at college, and you obviously applied it to the front
pieces. Yeah, I did a technical and scientific illustration course.
Right.
A vocational course. And on that, I learned to do what was then technical illustration. All it meant was, first of all, learning how to use the airbrush for technical illustration. Wasn't using graphics then.
Mm.
Was beginning to in my last year of college. You know, there was a big fuss about it in the graphic department because people like Alan Jones and others were using it, and so they all wanted to use the airbrush. But I learned to use the airbrush then, and also the line and dot technique was how you illustrate scientific illustrations,
okay,
medical illustrations and that, you know, very clean lines and with dots for skull. If you're illustrating a skull, I still have, you know, a picture I did of a monkey skull, exactly the same way as I did the doctors.
Wow.
And it was really weird because, you know, as I was growing up, I was a big fan of comics. And I had loads of them. And, you know, they influenced me enormously of what I wanted to do. And Frank Bellamy was my favorite artist. And it was really weird because here am I, you know, following up from where he left off, doing, you know, the dot technique, which he used as well. It makes me think if perhaps he learned it for doing technical manuals or something when in his young career. I don't know. But, well, yeah, line and dot. Drives you bonkers, but it's got to be done.
It's a longer process then.
Yeah, it's tedious. It's and you got to have good reference for it, especially if you're dealing with likenesses of the doctors and the creatures, really. But reference is everything to an artist who's, you know, an illustrator, especially. So we rely on reference a lot.
And that actually links in with my next question. I mean, was there ever anything that the actors featured in the artwork wanted you to change at all?
You heard about this, haven't you?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, one day I got a letter from the publishers, and it was a copy of a letter written to them by John Pertwee's agent, or I don't know, complaining that John Pertwee doesn't like his large nose on the covers. And I thought they were doing a practical joke on me. And I really did, you know.
Yeah.
And I didn't pay attention to it, of course, you know. But when I met Pertwee in a convention, I mentioned it to him with a smile in my face, you know, thinking we were going to have a laugh about it. But he was really grumpy. still grumpy about it. Oh, I don't know. I don't think he liked me very much because of that.
And was it more of a challenge to draw, you know, the actors or the monsters? Because I suppose with the monsters, you've got those really intricate details, haven't you?
Yeah.
That you need to capture and then...
Well, they're fun to draw, you know. Mm. I mean, on TV, they're rubbish, you know. Especially the early ones,
yeah.
You know. But on TV, they rely on lighting, and they should have relied on lighting and photographic tricks, you know, to make them look plausible. But on the drawings, you know, when you're drawing them, they're fun to do, you know.
And did you have a favourite doctor and a favourite monster?
I have a favourite doctor, for sure, and that was always Patrick Troughton. For some reason, I liked him on the television. I think he made a great doctor, you know. He was everything. He was, you know, in it. And liked him a lot. Tom Baker was also brilliant. I think he adopted the role with full gusto, you know. He just loved being the doctor, you can tell. And but he was hard to draw because of all his curly hair. And that big scarf of his came handy in designing the covers. When he came to drawing them, though, it was getting very laboriously dotting away from that. But Troughton had this fantastic sleek black hair. He got some good, great poses he did, you know, would make good covers. Like the Bondable Snowman and that, you know. Those. Yeah, there's no doctor on that one.
Come on, Dave.
Dave's just showing us some of the book covers while we're talking. Yes, he
is. There we go.
Yeah.
So that's three doctors.
That's the three doctors. So you're going to ask me about the hands.
Yes. Yeah,
they're straight. Another one of my big influences, you know, I love. Great artists around doing comics, you know, in those days. Still are, I suppose, but not in this magnitude. You know, there was Jack Kirby in America who did the, you know, the American comics. And the godfather of American comics. And I adored his stuff, you know, his graphics. I met him later in the Comic-Con in America. And he was wonderful. And he, you know, he shook my hand and he says, he complimented me in my work. He knew about me and my work, which was great.
Yeah.
But I loved his work, you know. And once I thought of that idea, I could not get it out of my mind. So I thought, let's do a Jack Kirby on this one. So why not? Yeah. There you go.
Yeah, with the energy going down. I mean, the something which I have noticed in your artwork, Chris, especially with the Target books, is the monsters are always, or most of the time, seem to be in colour, whilst the doctors seem to be in black and white. I mean, is there a certain...
Not always, some cases. In some of them, I even left the doctor out completely.
Right, yeah.
I got a bit of flack from that as well, from the publishers.
Right.
But they learned to accept what I deliver.
Mm.
And, sometimes I airbrush the doctor's head, you know, just for a change, or painted him. Because, it's nice to make them a little bit different. And I will do the same again, you know. Mm. You can't, I did 30-odd covers. How many did I do, David?
About 28, 29 covers, I believe.
28, 29 covers.
Yeah. Yeah.
And some other graphic things, you know. And you can't be doing the same thing all the time.
No.
That's the difficulty of this thing, you know, finding a new layout for it.
Mm.
That makes sense. I usually try to convey the story in the cover, capture the what's going on, you know, capture the whole story in basically one little picture on the cover.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, and of course that's the Autumn Invasion was one of the first covers which you did. And I mean, so when we were speaking earlier about, you know, the reference material, I suppose when stories were a little bit closer in transmission, because I think it was 74 that the Autumn Invasion novel came out, and of course the TV episode was only 4 years earlier.
Yeah.
I mean, would that be a little bit easier for you if the stories were sort of closer in time? Or?
Yeah, I would. Yeah. I would. Like I said, I used to watch it.
Yeah.
So I would remember the story. But I wasn't really after a synopsis, you know. I wasn't saying to the publishers, I must know what the story is about. Give me the script or give me a synopsis at least. Mm. No, I was after references.
Yeah.
Visual references. Because that's what made the covers.
Mm.
Because I already knew the stories from watching the TV. And that's all there was, remember. There was no video, nothing.
No.
You know, once it was broadcast, that was it.
Mm.
Gone. So I relied on that.
Yeah. And of course, with the Tenth Planet one, that was very vibrant, very colourful. I remember when I bought it from the bookworm in Clacton. Uh-huh. I remember buying that book, and it really, really jumped out at me. I mean,
but there's no doctor on
there. There's no doctor on the front. No, but the Cybermen, because they're such an engaging character, you know, creature.
Yeah.
Exactly.
You see, I knew how to do these covers better than the publishers. Publishers would have said, oh, you've got to have the doctor's face on there, doctor's head.
Mm.
Not necessary.
No.
Because I know how the young people thought. You know, I bought comics for how many years, you know, and I know how young people think. And the Cybermen, like you say, are so punchy, so, you know, amazing to look at. So I just had to make a big splash of them.
Mm.
And everybody knows, you know, picked up that book. It's a Doctor Who book anyway.
Mm.
But they wanted to see the Cybermen.
Yeah.
And I probably got... Is it the first one I did without the Doctor's head? I'm not sure. It might have been.
Tenth Planet was, yeah.
It might have been. Mm. It's probably then that they complained. And they said, do it again, Chris, you know, with the Doctor's head.
Mm.
And I refused to do it because by then I had another deadline to fulfill.
Mm.
You know? And they still published it.
Mm. I'm pleased they did. That's one of my favourite covers, that one.
I stood my ground because I knew I was right. But it's your living, you know, when you're an illustrator.
Mm.
It's not a hobby, you know.
Mm.
You haven't got private income, you know, and you're doing it for a laugh. It's your living, you know, and you take risks and you got to earn a living from it.
Mm. And do you have one that really sticks out for you? One that you really think, yeah, I was really, that's one of my best.
Genesis was my favourite for a long time. The Ice Warriors.
Mm.
I mean, I look at that and I see perfect design, you know, perfect layout, perfect book cover.
Mm.
You can't beat that. It's one of my favourite ones.
So the better the design of the monster, then...
It's just how lucky you get with reference and then making that black and white still, you know, work in a design. Which is where I good at, you know. I've got to admit, you know, I've got a good eye for good design and layout. And, I mean, the Web of Fear is a fantastic cover with the web going around the Doctor's head. You know, that's a good one too.
It seemed like there was a familiarity, there was a degree of familiarity with your artwork. And then, of course, like I said, when you broke away with, you know, maybe not putting the Doctor's head on the front or including them, what was your thinking behind the introduction of the infamous clack on the front cover of the Dinosaur Invasion? Was that just to sort of bring a different style to it, or just to...
I wasn't deliberately being a rebel or any kind, you know.
Right.
I didn't really set out to upset anyone. It's just worked as a design, you know, as a design on the cover. And once I thought of it and penciled it in, I couldn't get rid of it. It's just too good to get rid of. And being a big comic fan, like I said, you know, it just made sense to me to put another dimension in its sound, in a way. Because when kids pick that up, I know they're going to go, clack, clack. You know, they're going to have fun with it.
Yeah.
And that's why I did it. And again, they told me, you can't do this, Chris. You've got to remove that. And I just wouldn't do that.
No.
So they published it and got a lot of mail saying how brilliant it was.
Yeah.
Used to get a lot of mail from kids, sometimes with drawings of copies of my covers. I still have some of them in the cupboard somewhere. And I couldn't reply to all of them, so I discouraged it. Because I was just too busy. And the editor did suggest we start a fan club. Make a big fuss of it to sell more books, I suppose. And I said, no, I haven't got... I said, does that mean I have to reply to all the letters? She said, well, it will help. I said, no way. I haven't got time to do that. You know, I said, you can reply to them if you like. But I can't sit down and do that. So the fan club never materialized. But I was moving on from then. You know, Doctor Who was becoming, you know, after doing them for a while, it became something I fitted in, you know, rather than excited to be doing it. Because I was more excited doing my fantasy work.
Yeah.
And doing big paintings of fantasy subjects. And Doctor Who, especially, I mean, in when did I stop doing them? Stop doing
77.
Them? 77 or something.
Yeah. How did your association with the Doctor Who target book range end? Yeah.
It ended
back then. Sorry,
back then, yes. It was a messy breakup.
Right.
And I wish it wasn't, but it was. There was a change of art director then. Some new director came in, and he hasn't been long there. And he was a nice enough guy. And he asked me to bring in the artworks back of the previous things I've done. The Doctor Who monster books. Remember, I did two of those. Big montages of all creatures. They were large paintings, much larger than the covers. And some other things, some other covers. So I brought them all in. He said it's because we got to do some publicity on the books. And I said, well, okay, as long as you look after them and return them. And he said, sure, don't worry, Chris. And so he gave me another Doctor Who cover to do. So I'll go back with the delivery of the artwork. And I'm asking, you know, have you finished with the other paintings? And he said, well, not yet, Chris, not yet. Next time I go in again. And weeks go by, and I keep asking about them. And he keeps saying, we haven't got them. So then I began to get a bit worried. So I demanded that they should come back to me. And it's only till then that they told me what they were really for. And actually I got it wrong way around. When I made a fuss was when, I remember that, it's a long time ago. I got through the post, I had a friend in America, and he sent me a copy of the equivalent of the TV Times. A5 little booklet of the TV Times.
Yeah.
And on the cover was my painting.
Oh, right.
I mean, it sold, God knows how many hundreds of thousands of copies this TV Times sells in America. And it was when they the BBC franchised the Doctor Who series for American TV. And it was all over the States, you know. And they didn't tell me about it. That's what they wanted them for, to promote the series. And of course they have no rights for that. The license they have was for the British and Commonwealth book rights only. Mm. And that was it. So I went in with this and I showed it to the art director, and that's when I created the farce. And he owed up and he said, well, we sent it to the BBC, they asked for them. But they didn't tell us what it was for. And it's not our fault. You have to go to the BBC and ask them. So I said, I want the artwork back straight away. And they got the artwork back, thank goodness. But then I contacted the BBC, and he said, nothing to do with us. We assume W.H. Allen had the rights to they gave us the illustrations, and we thought that, you know, they were clear of copyright.
Mm.
And so they passed it back, one to the other. In the end, I went to the Association of Illustrators to sort it out. I was a member then, and they did bugger all. Mm. You know, they never did. It was over by then. The whole thing was a farce.
Mm.
And I still got all the letters, correspondence, all the fuss, you know. Nothing, came to nothing, not even an apology, nothing. I mean, to tell you, if the Americans asked to use my artwork for what they used it for, it would have been a lot of money changing hands for that.
Mm.
A lot of money. And I lost out on that because they passed my illustrations on without even asking me, although it was my copyright, not theirs. They have don't have the copyright. They have a license to reproduce the illustrations on the book covers only, and for any promotional material for the British and Commonwealth, as it was then, distribution. Right. No other rights. I mean, I found out later also they were selling them to all sorts of other countries, weren't they? We found even a Turkish book, you know, three or four foreign language editions, which they never told me about. But after that, you see, I said, I'm not doing any more for them. And the art director said, well, okay, Chris, don't worry, no problem, we'll get someone else to do them. And I remember laughing at him and saying, okay, good luck with that one. he actually asked me, then he came back, that's it. I went home and he called me a few weeks later, said, Chris, you got to help me out. I need more time to find another artist. Can you do three more covers, for us, you know? And he practically begged me, you know, so I said I'd do them, but that's it. That's the end. I'm not doing any more. That was the Seeds of Doom and the Ark in Space and one other. And they were the last ones I did. And that's how we parted. Not very well.
No.
And I just didn't want anything to do with Doctor Who after that.
No.
I put the paintings away. Nobody wanted them through the 80s anyway. Then David Howell came up. And from the other... Was it 10th anniversary or something? Or 20th anniversary, one of those. 20th anniversary. And he asked me to do... he ran the Doctor Who Appreciation Society. So he wanted me to do an illustration to celebrate that. A limited edition, and so we did that. And while he was there, I mean, he was crazy Doctor Who fan, and he bought some of my best early covers next to nothing, because I didn't think there were any value on them. Nobody wanted them, and he bought them next to nothing really, and there were thousands now. And all through the 80s, you know, they were just, you know, I was giving them away, really, you know.
And, of course, you moved on, like you said, you did more fantasy illustration as well, of course.
Yeah.
Movie posters as well.
I moved on, you know, I was doing well. I had my first book on my artwork was published in 1977, Beauty and the Beast. and I sold our hotcakes in many languages, and then followed up by Beauty Sirens, and that the same, very, you know, full of fantasy art and other things, including the Doctor Who's and Star Trek pictures I'd done, and, but mainly fantasy, and they sold very well indeed. Even did a Japanese edition and a Polish edition. Including European editions, American, huge American editions. So I was very popular and in demand.
And of course,
and I left Doctor Who's behind, you know.
Yeah, and so, then Ridley Scott came calling.
Well, he did, you know, it wasn't him, it was Warner Brothers.
Okay.
Wanted me to design the Blade Runner poster. They already had one, an American one, and they were panicking because it was, the film flopped in America for some reason.
Right, okay.
And they wanted a new poster. So I went in and they... I must have been one of the first people in public to view Blade Runner in one of those private theatres in Wardour Street.
Mm.
I remember sitting down, being blown away by all this imagery. And then I had to go and meet Ridley Scott and his wife upstairs and the Warner Brothers man. And discuss what to do with it.
Mm.
And I said, well, it's an amazing movie, but I need to see it again because, and you know, there's so much in it. It's full of visual material, and I need to see it again. I said, that's fine. But I said, I don't know who said what, but they told me they didn't want to see the science fiction then. They didn't want to sell it as science fiction. Because for some reason, science fiction wasn't popular then, they told us. So we don't want a science fiction. I said, well, it's a sort of all right, but it's a bit film noir type of film. I said, no, we don't want it to look like film noir or a gangster kind of movie. So it's up to you to come up with something, Chris. So I said, oh, okay. So I came home and got as many stills as I could from me, as they could give me. And got on doing some roughs and concepts and things. But it was an amazing movie. Holds to this day. It's a very good movie. And, yeah, I met Ridley Scott and his wife briefly. That's it. That's about it. No big deal.
And then, of course, you've come back to Doctor Who in more recent times with commissions for artwork for...
SFX magazine.
That's the one, yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
They are celebrating Doctor Who in there.
Mm.
And they commissioned me to do three covers, I think. And for that. So I started, I did them again. But I think before that, there was another magazine who asked me to do, when it started up again, with Christopher Eccleston.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they asked me to do a picture for that, but they hadn't. It was all top secret. They didn't want to give anything away, so I had nothing to work with.
Right.
Hardly. So it was very difficult.
Yeah.
But I managed to do it. Yeah. Then there was a big break, and the SFX magazine asked me to do three more. But you know, I have a lot of fans of this, of these artworks, and. Occasionally I get a request to do an original painting for someone, and I paint them the same way as I always did, on A2 size board, the same technique, and pick a story. Sometimes I let them choose a story, and if it's from the old doctors I like, you know, I would agree and do it. But sometimes they say, anyone, Chris, just you pick the doctor, we love them all. So I would do one for them as private commissions, and I sell the artworks then as artworks. The copyright of the image, of course, is mine. So they have no rights to reproduce. The reproduction I do through my website, I sell the prints of them. And I get quite a few orders for those.
Yeah.
And that's how it goes, because there's a lot of fans out there still.
Going back to...
Yeah, all these years, my God. I don't know, how many years is it then?
42 years.
Yeah. 42 years! Put that down. good thing or a bad thing.
Well, yeah. All I have to say, Professor Kilios, thank you very much for all your fantastic illustrations and front covers over the years that, for this boy talking to you now, he used to grab them off the bookshelves and many other boys and girls as well.
Oh, well, delighted. Thank you very much.
No problem. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Diddly Dum Podcast. Find us on our blog at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com, on iTunes, Facebook, Audioboo, and Stitcher.com at Diddly Dum. On Twitter at diddly_dum, or email us at diddlydumpodcast@yahoo.co.uk.
Diddly Dum, the empty space that circles time.